Shas from Masur Skosavos is Zaidi was in Yeshiva, I still remember him. Remember in Yom Nerai, who Kala talked about what it was like in the mirror, the intensity of the tefillahs. And it's a big schos for us to have you, especially after Shlach, after Tzitzis as well. So thank you so much for joining us.
There's something that I've, interesting phenomenon that I've observed regarding Tchilas. You'd expect it to be a pretty straightforward shiloh. Pretty straightforward, so again, you know, somebody's presenting perhaps an interesting new chumrah, an interesting new halacha. And the reaction should be pretty straightforward. You know, we have a lot of patterns for other such. People are proposing other similar proposals. I don't know. I'd show up with a new car in the Vesterik. For years in Europe, I think the only Vesterik that was widely available was the Italian Vesterik. And, you know, people bump into Yemenites and to Moroccans, and then, you know, the shaila is going to come up regarding the pros and cons of, you know, using a Yemenite Vesterik, what the Rias would be, would you go with Rias, would be taking in, you know, the traditions of the Yemenites, how good or bad, you know, they would be. Would they be better or worse than the Moroccans, and then the Moroccan and the Yemenites against the regular minhag and so on? Now, there's a regular pattern that we have in the Sefer HaPesachim for such a shiloh. And surprisingly, I don't see that pattern taking place when it comes to Tchilas. There seems to be an automatic knee-jerk reaction that no, we don't have Tchilas. That's not Anocha Kduma. If you start the shiloh of Tchilas, you'd expect, well, I'm proposing a proposal. Let's deal it, you know, according to the merits of the evidence. And it would seem, from the way, you know, from their actions I've gotten over the years, that people assume as a davar pasha, no, it can't be. I'm not very sure where that comes from, but I've noticed a mirror image of that reaction somehow the other way around when it comes to people who are pro-tchilas, that you see that they suddenly have, there's some kind of energy to the pro-tchilas people. They make it sound a little more, the positivity that they have is a little bit beyond the regular proposal of yet another chumrah. Yeah, there's a leaflet over here that I'm the guilty party. I was behind this nearly 15 years ago, actually about 15, 16 years ago I wrote this, in an earlier Mahadura. I haven't seen similar, you know, pamphlets being given out proposing that we should or shouldn't use Nipitz Lashma and Artzitzis or Chveis, you know, what kind of ink we should be using in our tefillin, even though those discussions should be, again, pretty similar. And what I've come to realize, and this is something that really is a backdrop of the whole sugya and gives a lot of coloring to the entire shayla, is we tend to associate tchilas for some reason. I can't say anyone, I understand entirely why. We tend to associate tchilas with something to do with the gula. There could be a lot of reasons for that. It could be entirely psychological. It could be the fact that it matches the color of a certain country's flag. It could be a lot of other things that, to a certain extent, the fact that we didn't have a mitzvah for so long, and it was a davar pasha by the Pesachim, we discuss it, has a lot of relevance, understanding the sugya of tzitzis, we'll see a little later. Tchilas has a lot of relevance even when you don't have tchilas, regarding perhaps how many strings you have in tzitzis, how many strings could rip in your tzitzis while it still would be kosher, and so on and so forth. So in the middle of the Pesachim are forced to discuss a lot about tchilas, and any such discussion will assume, well, at some point when we have tchilas one day, and obviously it's going to be, the gist of it's going to be when Mashiach comes, we'll have tchilas. To a large extent, I think that's part of the culprit, that we tend to associate tchilas with, pass them around, might help for the tzibur. We tend to associate Tchilas Memelo with something to do with the Gula. There could be more to it than that, but the very idea of a mitzvah disappearing and being brought back to Klal Yisrael is something that has almost no parallel, and as such was always associated. Mashiach for sure is going to bring back Tchilas, and then the next extension of that statement is Tchilas won't come back until Mashiach is here. If you look through Pesachim, you won't find a serious attitude like that. You won't find any of the major Pesachim saying that Tchilas is a mitzvah, it's telling the Mikdash. you will find overtones of such an idea, such as the Arizal, for example, who associates the lack of tchilas with something to do with the world that we live in, the non-Gula world, and obviously Mamela is going to come back when Mashiach comes. If you know a little bit about Arizal, you obviously realize, regardless of the, you know, the horror of Rabbi Kiva Eger, the Eil of Tishmon, I'm sure you're familiar, even if we would look at the Arizal as a Navi, the question is what the import of a statement is. It's a little bit parenthetical. I'll just say the Arizal tends in general to try to interpret reality based on Teres HaSoid. So the Arizal would find it a valid discussion to discuss why usually the boy is older than the girl in a marriage. Some Sfaradim will tell you, therefore, you shouldn't marry a girl that's older than you. And there's a beautiful tshuva from Yaakov Hillel, where he says, no, that Arizal is just interpreting reality. Doesn't mean that you have to do it like that. I'll just throw out there, there's a beautiful piece I found years ago from the Divrei Yoel, the Satmarov actually. He writes, it's not clear what his insinuation is. I think we could pretty easily guess what his insinuation is. But the Satmarov says that we see from the Python, it's actually a pretty early piyut, Asher Heini, which you say after the Megillah. I don't know if anyone's familiar with the piyut Asher Heini, but in Asher Heini, it finishes off, Shoshanat Yaakov, Tzalva Samech, Baris Yimechad, Tchilas Mardechai. And using this Arizal, the Satmarov says a beautiful drush that seeing Mardechai with Tchilas was sort of seeing the beginning of the Geula. The insinuation from the Satmarov, by the way, is that, you know, today, of course, when there's no Tchilas, there's of course no Geula. Which might, to a certain extent, be able to explain a little bit of some of the snagdus that's out there in the world, perhaps. I just find it interesting, or perhaps intriguing. Again, the way the Satmarov looks at it, of course, is that even before the Geula comes, there's going to be Tchilas. And he says it pretty clearly, like having, I think he even uses in the context the words Eschalta de Geula, seeing Mardechai with Tchilas would be a remez for Eschalta de Geula or something like that. In any case, putting that all aside, there are midrashim here and there that say certain things like the fact that Tchilas is Nignas. In the world of Halacha, which one example I bring on the sheet in front of you is the Ma'aril, regarding the question of, it actually was one of the most hotly contested shaylos in the period of the Gaonim, as to whether a linen talus would be chayiv in tzitzis. The Gemara says a talus that's made out of linen is not chayiv in tzitzis because, or at the very least, not chayiv in tchilas, because somebody might use tchilas as pasul, and kalayim in tzitzis, putting on wool tzitzis, would only be mutter if you have tchilas, which must be with wool, otherwise I'd be able to use linen tzitzis. And memela, the Gemara explains, it's a little bit of a complicated Gemara and a big complicated Tosfos. But the bottom line is that there's no tzitzis when there's either no tchilas or no tzitzis on a linen garment. But that's all contingent on tchilas existing. And therefore the shaila arises, what would happen in our day and age, say the Paiskim, when we don't have any tchilas, would you be able to wear a talus made out of linen? The shaila comes up periodically. You see it in Shulchan Aruch, much earlier in the Gaonim. It was still a widely contested shaila till the times of the Vilna Gaon, when some people in Vilna did wear linen talism, some people didn't. In the Vilna Gaon's own lifetime, this has nothing to do with the Shir, there was a widely contested shaila in his lifetime as to what the Vilna Gaon's talus is made out of in his lifetime. One of the most bizarre things I've ever seen. It turns out it was probably some kind of other interesting material, but not for right now. Again, the shaila is whether bizman hazeh, when there is no tchelas, if you'd be able to wear tzitzis on a linen talus. And that's, of course, dependent on whether there isn't tchelas. If there's no tchelas and there's no chance of tchelas coming back, then, well, nothing really to be concerned with because people are just going to use linen tzitzis and nobody's going to put on pasul tchelas because nobody wears tchelas at all, and you're back to regular white linen tzitzis on a white linen talus and life is grand. And the Ma'aril says, in the Tshuvas Ma'aril in the Ksav Yad, it's known as the Tshuvas Ma'aril HaChadashas, a sefer that the Beis Yosef had, he just called them Tshuvas Ashkenazias. And the Ma'aril over there says that you can't just write off this possibility because who knows, maybe tchilas will come back. You could see it right in the beginning, it's the first statement on the first page of the page leaflet. It says, It's plausible, reasonable that Tchelos might come back, especially since the Smag, and he's just quoting the Rambam through the Smag, that the Dag Chalazin is Matzoy, and it's in the Yam HaMelech. I point that in a footnote. Yam HaMelech is just a Hebraism of an Arabic term meaning the Yam HaGadol. And Bekal L'Hayolas is Tchelos. It should theoretically be easy to make Tchelos. Why he didn't go make Tchelos? Obviously, the Merle lives in Germany. I don't know how many times in his life the Marilla actually was able to see the sea. And I don't know if he would have known, you know, whether it was possible. Sometimes you wonder if it's Bekal to make Tchelos, go ahead and do it. But putting that question aside, which perhaps we'll get back to a little later, the Marilla and many other Pesachim through the Daris discuss the Shaila Tchelos, and they don't make this association with the Gula. The flip side, you know, in basic logic, if it's raining, I carry an umbrella. If I carry an umbrella, it doesn't necessarily imply that it's raining. I might be a brisker. There could be a lot of other reasons I'd be carrying an umbrella. That's the basic flaw in logic. When Mashiach comes, there will be tchelos, but that doesn't imply that if not Mashiach, then not tchelos. That's, in any case, the feeling that I get from the Paiskim. Perhaps we'll get back to this in detail after this year. Being as such, theoretically, the Shaila should be, again, fairly simple. Let's just figure out what you make tchelos from and get it from there. It doesn't really work so well. You look at the Gemara, there's a Gemara, which actually perhaps comes from a Tesefta, perhaps Tais just a parallel source. We find that the Gemara, that the Tchelos is made from a Chalazin. I don't know how many of you have 3-4-year-old kids in the local kindergartens, but one of the basic Yitzirot in the fall is actually a song about it that the kids sing. No idea exactly how the song goes, but there's a lot of different songs about the fall and the rain and the Chilazin, the Chilazon, as the kids call it, and all the kids, of course, know. Chilazon is a snail, right? There's no real questions about that. The reason why we're so sure about it is thanks to a brilliant scholar by the name of Eliezer, I think, Perlman, Ben Yehuda, of course, who revised the Hebrew language and needs a word for snail, and, of course, pulls out the word chilazon. He has no doubts about it, and that, of course, influences our kids who have no sphakis. Ben Yehuda was a big bucky in Gemara. He's a brilliant scholar. Is well worthy of the job that he did. The source that he gives, though, in his monumental dictionary is not the Gemaras, which we'll see in a moment. Basically, you can ask any local Arab and many other Middle Eastern languages, Syriac, both Eastern and Western Syriac, Farsi, and many other Middle Eastern languages. There's a commonly used word, halazun, halzuno, a couple of different ways to say it, and it means snail. Actually, you know, it's always fun to get something Mesiach Lefitume from a guy because that's how it works. I remember years back, I learned in a kill in Rechavia, Netzach Yisrael, Ramailas. There was a hall upstairs, and it was in the winter, you know. Shkia was early, middle of second Seder. And I was standing in the front, I think talking on my phone. I don't remember exactly what I was doing. It was raining, of course. Anyone knows in Yerushalayim, you'll see lots of slugs. Perhaps we'll get that a little later. Snails, and there was this Arab fellow going in and out of the hall with a big crates of food and plates and stuff like that. And as he's walking in and out, I'm watching, there's this big, huge snail on the floor. He's walking through and goes crunch, splat. And you hear the Arab go with a couple of good curses, and then halazuno, I gvaldik. I got my guy Mesiach Lefitumai. This would be kashal halacha for any other sugya in chas. But putting Ben Yehuda aside, I think it would be fairly easy to come to the conclusion that a chalazin is a snail. You'd be surprised how surprising that is. If you're living in Europe 100, 200 years ago, you look at anything in the Gemara potentially as some kind of shade. Now, what would you know? You know, I don't know what a chalazin is. I still remember I had a conversation, I think about 15 years ago, with a big Talmud Chacham, some today's a known Talmud Chacham from England. I was in England for a visit, and this Talmud Chacham was schmoozing. It was the night after a wedding. It was late at night. We had taken a ride back together from northern England to the middle of England and to London, I think. And we're schmoozing about all kinds of different things. And I asked, like, what are you doing? What are you up to? What are you doing in Yerushalayim? And I said, lately I've become interested in the sugya Tchelos. Tchelos? So I said, yeah, Tchelos. I said, you know, I've even got the chalazin under my bed, my dear, in a little tub. And he looks at me as if I just told him that I collect dragons. you've got a chalazim. I said, yeah, well, certainly. What's the problem? And I'm looking at his face, and there's like the most utter shock. Entirely not put on. Trying to figure out what's so surprising. And at some point, he like blurts out, but it's huge. Where do you get that from? After another couple of minutes of going around the bush, I suddenly realized, in his mind, there's one creature called a chalazim, or levyazin, something like that. He had lumped the chalazim and the levyazin into one creature. Without any jokes, what's going on in his mind, something in the Gemara isn't necessarily something in the here and now in the real world. And it's not something you'd expect to find as you're walking down the street. If you look through the Gemara, that would entirely not be the impression you'd get. Where do we find the chalazim? There's a couple of different contexts where it pops up in Midrashim. One of the ones that I find most telling is a Medrash quoted in Rashi. I bring it in the second column where I talk about the chalazim. The first is the Tesefta and the Gemara that says Tchelis comes from chalazim. The Tesefta actually says that if it's not from chalazim, Tchelis is puzzle. Perhaps later we'll discuss why that would be. And it says, you see in the parentheses over there, it's a little bit too long. I have to admit, this paper was made to impress Haredim. There's something, when it comes to yeshivish people, that if you want to impress them, you got to show that you're a heavy hitter. You throw as many Maram Kaimis as you can, if possible in tiny font, if possible in tiny Rashi font, and then you got the guys. If you got a lot of Maram Kaimis in tiny Rashi font with a lot of abbreviations, then you've made it. That's a conclusive argument. So I pander to that, embarrassingly. And I write about the fact that it has a ba'alat kunchia. This is a Dvarim Rabba, Shirim Rabba, many other Midrashim. Of course, it's the same Medrash appearing in parallel sources, where it talks about the Yidden in the Midbar. Klal Yisrael in the Midbar, they grow and they don't have any new clothes. And the Medrash asks, or some person in the Medrash asks, if they're not growing, what's happening to their clothes? Right? And the Medrash says, no, their clothes is growing with them. And don't be surprised. Hare Matsanu Chilazin. Something like that. Now, you can always write this off that it just means the skin. If it means the skin, why would you have to go to chalazim? Let's just use human. As humans grow, the skin grows with them, right? Obviously, what we're trying to say is that, no, it's not just your skin. It's something exterior, something surprising that you'd see it grow with you. Something that puzzled people in the ancient world. On creatures that seem to have an inorganic shell that's a rack for all practical purposes. It actually is a rack, and it doesn't seem to be connected to the exterior of the shell, and somehow every year it's getting bigger and bigger. Indeed, Pilei Abria. In any case, the fact that we're describing the chalazim as something that has a shell that grows bigger, an exterior shell, I think that would be enough to prove it to be a snail. If that weren't enough, there's Yerushalmi that talks about whether you can or can't kill a chalazim on Shabbos. It's part of a bigger sugya, the famous sugya about killing lice, really, is part and parcel of that, but that's a different sugya. And within the context, it asks about, things that live 6 months have bones and gidim. And the chalazim is brought up. What about the chalazim? It lives more than 6 months, or a chalazim, perhaps I should say. A chalazim can live for more than 6 months, and it doesn't seem like it has bones and gidin. And then it answers, perhaps it does, like every other Yerushalmi you left when you finished learning the Yerushalmi, scratching up, was that all bitmiya? Was the end bitmiya? Is it a yibayit le'ifshita or something else? And like every other Yerushalmi, you'll find as many mefarshim as there are on the sugya, the armahalchim. But the basic gist that you can pull out of the Yerushalmi is that it's certainly the understanding of Yerushalmi that you wouldn't expect the chalazim to have gidim atzamis. As you're talking about some squishy, mushy thing that has a shell. I think that's a fair description of a snail. Putting that together with the fact that the chalazim in Arabic and all these other languages, which, by the way, over the years I've gotten it more and more times, I was shooting a documentary film about Chelis, and as we're schmoozing about it, and schmoozing about the filming, we're talking about chilazin, 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 and the taxi driver, who wasn't Jewish, was here in Israel, though, he's like looking at me puzzled. I said, he seems to recognize something. Can I say that? So we're talking about a halazuno. Ah, halazuno, yeah, sadafe. And this happened many other times since. There's no spakus about it. The one Arab who I ended up shooting for the for the video. After we finished, you know, shooting the video, I said, like, what's this? And he says, halazun, and so on. So after we finished videoing him, I give him 100 shekel for his help. He said, hey, for another 200 shekel, I'll call whatever you want. But Mesiach Lefitume is Mesiach Lefitume, and any other, there's no end of dictionaries and so on and so forth that you can get to back up this point. Chalazin is most certainly a snail. It has a lot of relevance regarding the end of the sugya, because everything we're going to discuss about the chalazin is going to have to be in the context of a snail that, whatever. In other words, if I were to demonstrate that a chalazin has tzeda, for example, sugya Masech Shabbos, that you'd be chayv tzod for trapping a chalazin, perhaps, that wouldn't be able to, I wouldn't therefore say that chalazin must have wings, like I actually was once told by someone. I'm not sure where he got it from. I actually went to Rav Zalman Achemya after that discussion in which a well-known Pesach told me, where's the Chalazin's wings? By the way, what I answered to him at the time was, I looked at him like, where do you get that from? That's a Teichik Teretz. Where did I get that from? So I thought for a moment, I said, what are you talking about? Right after it says that it has wings, it says, Kibin Shietzim Ayam, Yad Noishreis. And he looks at me, oh, okay. Neither source exists. Course. Right, so I went back to Rav Zalman Chaim Goldberg, and again, I was very disappointed by the turn of the conversation, and that's really what he told me afterwards. People tend things that you're not familiar, you lump together. He probably lumped it with the Benisi de Beikar, bringing Masechus Makkos. But I wouldn't be able. What he was coming from in reality was the fact that you have say the Bayah Chalazin. So it's got to be something you can get away from me quickly. However, there is no such thing as a snail that can run very quickly. Perhaps a snail that can swim, perhaps, which is also rare. You know, mollusks of the snail type don't really have any muscles that they should be able to swim very quickly with. And maybe we're going to have to look for a different interpretation. But the basic fact that chilazin means a snail, I would say, is 100% conclusive. So shaila would be automatically, which snail are we looking for? We can't just go to the yam and look for no end of snails. There is a Gemara that gives us a little bit of information. There's a Gemara Maseches Menachos. It looks more than anything like an Agadata. I bring it, I think, on the third page in the middle of the centerfold. There's a Braisa about the Chalazin and Maseches Menachos. Chalazin Deimel Yam, Briyasei Deimel Adag, Oyla Achas Hashem Shano, Ubedame Tzevin Tcheles. It's a little bit problematic for a very simple reason. There's almost no statement in that description that's in any way definitive. Deim liyam can have multiple meanings, a whole range of colors, and doesn't exactly explain what part of the snail is deim liyam. Its eyes, its antennae, the body, the shell. Deim ledag. We have other such braises about briyasei deim, like about the shamir and various other places, about a nephil and maseches nida. You have this kind of terminology, and it's not very helpful. The only statement over here that's really helpful, which is pretty much circular, is the fact that you die from Tcheles. We know that you die from Tcheles. That's not going to help us identify it. But the truth is, really, if you use that as a starting point, I think you get to the conclusion in the most constructive manner. If we were to look for Tcheles and to understand as a Davar Pashut that Tcheles is something that's unique to Jews and something that's perhaps semi-mystical or semi-supernatural, so we really have no hope of looking for it. But if you look through Chazal, you can see that Tchilas is something perfectly natural. When the Bnei Yisrael come out of Mitzrayim, they have Tchilas from somewhere. Likely as not, again, this might be dependent on a sugi, whether you do or don't need the Shema for the Klei HaMishkan. But likely as not, they would have taken it from the Egyptians. Yaakov Avinu, according to one manuscript in a Medrash Rabbah, one of the things that he sends Yosef, not knowing that he's Yosef, amongst the whole present, he sends him chalazin, right? Which means that the Medrash is understanding, regardless as to whether this is or isn't historical fact, the Medrash is understanding that sending chalazin would be a normal thing for one royalty to send to another royalty. This is a chash of a thing, and it's not specifically unique to Jews. You find all through Tanakh, people wearing chalas. You find Mardukhai wearing chalas, Achashverosh wearing chalas. The Gemara talks about Nebuchadnezzar leaving in Eretz Yisrael, Jews after Churban Bayis Rishon, Lakarmim v'la Yegvim, and the Gemara says, what are Yegvim? The people are trapping the Chalazin, right? for the close of Nebuchadnezzar. The context, the impression that you're getting from the whole Shas is that Tchilis, like everything else, is not unique to Jews. I've never seen anyone try to claim that, let's say, I don't know, Zohav, if I were to try to make a tzitz today for the Kohen Gadol, I don't think there's anybody that would venture that perhaps Zohav is something, I don't know, something entirely unique to Jews. It's see-through. I'll find a couple of agadatas about Zohav. I'll tell you that there are 9 types of Zohav, 5 types of Zohav in Maseches Yuma. The indication from the Gemara Maseches Yuma is that pure Zohav can be 5 different colors, and that doesn't seem to be true about the material that in modern Hebrew we call Zahav. So no, there's Zohav, and that's Zohav, and of course what we like calling gold is just Bash Allah. I think we would all realize that such a contention is entirely ridiculous. I saw a kuntres, a spoof, on many of the anti-Tchilis literatures, and it's a whole seemingly serious-looking article trying to prove that what we call wine from grapes is not yayin, and what we call Concord grapes are not grapes. And he has no end of midrashim about the shape of a grape, the size of a grape, what real yayin does, and yayin is msameach, even if it's less than ervius, and what we call wine is entirely not. And a long list, and he says the obvious conclusion, of course, is that what we call wine is not wine, and Concord grapes are not grapes. And Chas v'Shalom to make a bari priya gofen on it, and right? And yayin shalahem, you know, you were able to be meizig at 1 to 4, and still was wine, and still make your sugar, and so on and so forth. The reason why we assume that not to be is because yayin is something that's never unique to Jews, something that everyone's got, and we've had it all through the generations. And anybody who knows Proto-Semitic and Ugarit, the Sumerian, Eblite, and practically every other language we have from the Middle East and from the Middle West and pretty much everywhere, is that yayin is yayin, and it's a common phenomenon. Tchilis would seem in Tanakh and all kinds of other external sources to be something universal. Just to top it off, we have a Gemara that talks about finding tchilis in the street, just like finding tefillin and discussing, and it might say tefillin, of course, whether it is or isn't kosher. The Gemara talks about finding tchilis, and the discussion, of course, is hadinos tchilis. Maybe it's imitation tchilis. Maybe it is imitation tchilis made from the indigo plant, of course. Maybe it's not lishma, and that's extremely important. By saying that it might be not lishma, a diet of the glima tzavinu, maybe somebody found this tchilis. You find a piece of tchilis in the street. How do you know you could use it for your tzitzis? Maybe somebody made it for his jacket. Maybe somebody made it for the fringes of his cloak. And which is what the Gemara contends as a possibility. The second I see that, that means that the Gemara assumes as a davar pashat that there are people who are wearing tchilis not just for a mitzvah. Tchilis is not unique to Jews. It's not unique to Jews for ritual purposes on their ritual garments. It's something that everyone's using. So really, all I would need to find, I think this would be the best way to find it, is to start from the end of the bride. So, ubedamit seven tchilis. Let's find the tchilis that's being used. So we would look for a dye. That's tchilis, theoretically, whatever color tchilis is. We'll get to that in a moment. And work from there and find some non-Jewish dye that's used at the same time in place as chazal. And theoretically, that would be tchilis. I would need to tack on one more caveat. It's got to be made from a snail. If I were to find a blue dye, see, I jumped ahead. If I were to find a dye from a snail, I think that would be enough for it, especially if I don't find a lot of dyes being made from any snail. What color is tchilis? Parenthetically, we all know, of course, tchilis is tchilit, you know, if you know modern Hebrew. Not really so accurate. Again, that's Ben Yehuda doing his work. It so happens to be, if you speak Russian, anyone here speaks Russian? The Russian speakers? Russian. English has 2 words for red. We call it either red or pink, and we consider them 2 very different colors. Not all languages have that. That distinction is not common to all languages. We also, in Russian, there's an identical distinction between dark blue and light blue. Sini and Galuboy, for Russian, and Ben Yehuda was forced, he was looking for a choice of words to parallel the color terms in Russian, and he picked kachol, for whatever reasons, and tchilit. Tchilit was just meant to parallel the Russian galuboy, light blue. That's not necessarily correct. See, sometimes Ben Yehuda got things wrong. What we do know, however, from Chazal is that Tcheles was forged using Kala Ilan, which seems to be understood by many Rishayim to be indigo, the plant that was used to make jeans, you know, jeans that haven't been washed out yet. I think more accurately, the plant, you don't have any English people here, do we? One breath, yeah. The policemen, I think they call them bobbies or something like that, or at least that's what it says in the written books. Somehow that's something to do with their uniforms, don't ask me why, but they wear very dark blue uniforms. The dark blue traditionally was made with indigo. It was one of the first major bumper crops of the United States when it was still a colony. I hope not to start with any insensibilities. It's been a while. In any case, indigo was a commonly known material through the generations, and was assumed by many Rishayim that indigo is Kali Ilam. So we're looking for something that would be forged with Kali Ilam, obviously the same color as dark jeans or British policemen's uniforms. There's other midrashim that I could find. Another one is this. This is a sapir of Tanakh. It's a stone that we know today as lapis lazuli. Not exactly what we would call today a sapphire. It probably had a different name in the ancient world. I think the identification of lapis lazuli with sapphire is conclusive. That's not for right now. There are numerous midrashim which call sapphire sapirinon, which is just a Greek term meaning lapis lazuli. So we're looking for something this color being made from a snail. The color is, I guess, dark blue with a teeny, teeny bit of a purplish tinge. It so happens to be that we know of such a dye. If you look at any of the ancient Greek texts about dyeing, about the dyes in particular, there's a dye stuff, I'm not sure exactly how to define it exactly, known as purpura, or purpura, spelled with either a pi or a phi, and it's being made, you know, discussed at great length from a snail. Hard to get exactly what the colors that are being discussed. Somewhere in the range between dark blue, purplish blue, all the way through, you know, purple and red. Theoretically, the discussion should end right here. I would venture that would be enough to satisfy our needs if we were really looking for the Tcheles. I remember years back, I think that's where I started my entire fixation on Tcheles. I think I was about 8 years old. We had in the house the Time Life, the series of Time Life science books. I don't know if any of you have seen that. And one of the books was on light and colors. And I remember reading on the bottom, I didn't bother reading the heavy stuff in the middle, but I always read the little tidbits of information around the margin. And there was something about a snail, and they made a purple dye. I read it. And I go running looking for my head. Patty, I found Tcheles. It was purple. It was a little bit of a problem, but, you know, logic told me that if they can make purple, they can make blue from it too. The colors are close enough, and perhaps the colors aren't close enough. I don't know. I didn't make this cheshbon. Maybe Tcheles is purple. That's a discussion of its own. In any case, like I started saying, I really would have said that this should be enough for the discussion. Why is that? If we're going to find a dye, basically blue, from the times of Chazal, that's being made by a snail, and there's no reference in Chazal or in the ancient literature that there are two, I would look for perhaps references in Pliny the Elder, who in his monumental encyclopedia of nature and pretty much everything under the sun discusses everything he knows about everything in the ancient world that was known to the Romans, and that includes of course Eretz Yisrael. And we could see from other books of his that he's intimately familiar with what's going on in Eretz Yisrael after the conquest of Eretz Yisrael. Even before that, you find many Roman geographers discussing Eretz Yisrael. Again, we're talking about the north of Eretz Yisrael under the Tyrian, you know, Tsar, which had been conquered, you know, by the West for a while. This is something that they're well aware of. If there's another kind of dye being made by some other kind of snail, you'd expect to hear about it from Pliny the Elder. If not from Pliny, you have writing from Aristotle, from Vitruvius, many, many other writers, and they're all talking about the same set of snails, making the same set of dyes called a perfura. On the flip side, I'd expect from Chazal to talk about, you know, there's the Yaakov and Esav. I could totally see a medrash talking about Yaakov and Esav and the tchilos of the Yidden and the tchilos of the Goyim and the chlaz and the Yidden, chlaz and the Goyim, and so on and so forth. That's something that you would expect, and you don't. And again, the reason for this is just like we find Zohav, Kesef, and Achoshes, which are identical for the Yidden and for the Goyim, and we never had the Zohav of the Yidden and the Zohav of the Goyim, the Yayin of the Yidden and the Yayin of the Goyim. I think that would hold true again for the Tchilos of the Yidden and the Tchilos of the Goyim. Like we find that Gemara in Erevin that I mentioned, you find Tchilos in the street, you should assume it to be the Tchilos of the Yidden. No possibility of, hey, maybe this is that terrible Perfura die, which is not the real Tchilos. There's no such consideration. If that weren't enough for us, we'd have a number of different ways to continue down this line of reasoning and see as to whether this would hold true as we look through the rest of the material that we have, Chazal, you know, Greek and Roman literature. One of the best sources, I would say, is Yerushalmi that we no longer have. I don't know how many of you learn Yerushalmi. Most of ours, in Tekufas Yerushalim, and most of us who learn Bavli with the Rishayim on the Bavli and the Paiskim, you constantly bump into the Yerushalmi through the Rishayim and Ashkenaz. That's our general exposure to Yerushalmi, unless, of course, you're learning Zerayim or something like that. And as you learn Yerushalmi and Ashkenaz, through the Ashkenazi Yerushalmi, you constantly find little snippets of Yerushalmi that look very different than what we have in front of us in the Yerushalmi. If you look in the back of any Yerushalmi, there's a book by a guy named Ber Ratner, Ashlamas Yerushalmi, or something along the lines of that. There are a number of different books that were made to collect all the snippets of Yerushalmi that we no longer have in front of us. And you can find quite a few of them, particularly in the school of the Ravan and Ravyo in Ashkenaz. They seem to have a totally different Yerushalmi. They have loads and loads of information. I don't know if anyone here has learned Beitza, Tainis. There are a bunch of different Gemaras that are discussed, a bunch of different Yerushalmis, I should say, that are discussed in the Beis Medrash from their citations in Ashkenazi Yerushalmi, which you open Yerushalmi, you're not finding them. The proposition had been made over the years that perhaps they had another book that they were calling Yerushalmi. I don't know, maybe they just, for some bizarre reason, called some early Rishon Yerushalmi, or perhaps some work of Gaonic literature was called Yerushalmi because somebody brought it from Yerushalayim. Maybe, yeah, you never know. If you look a little more carefully at the Rishonim, you see that that conjecture, which by the way was made in the scholarly world, not in the Beis Medrash, that conjecture doesn't hold any water because the Rishonim occasionally will talk about the Yerushalmi, and in the Nusach Acher of the Yerushalmi, it has it otherwise. So we're obviously talking about some version of the Yerushalmi. And they clearly considered it authoritative, something that they wouldn't have considered if it's just some other book, anonymous, from Tekufas Yerushalim. To our tremendous siyata d'shmaya, mazel, however you'd call it, they found what's known as the European Gniza. I don't know if anyone's familiar. All around libraries in Europe, there were many books, massive manuscript volumes, that were bound with, Rachmana Litzlan, the refuse of Ashkenazi manuscripts. A tremendous scholar by the name of Professor Zussman collected a number of pieces of Yerushalmi that were found scattered around. There was one encyclopedia that its volumes had been scattered around the world, around the medieval libraries, and it was bound with pieces of manuscript, a monumental manuscript of Yerushalmi, and these were pieced together, and through piecing all these pieces together, they were able to get 12 pages, folio pages, massive pages of a manuscript of Yerushalmi, 48 columns, front and back of each page. And we're able to reconstruct a lot of this Yerushalmi, and suddenly they realize that in a number of places it overlaps with parts of Yerushalmi that were quoted in Rishayim Ashkenaz, and sure enough, it has those very same expansions of the Yerushalmi that the Rishayim Ashkenaz are quoting. So that gives us a fair idea that the Rishayim and Ashkenaz have a Yerushalmi that's slightly broader than our Yerushalmi, Perhaps similar to our two versions of Yerushalmi for Shkolim, where it has two avenues of transmission, one through the Yerushalmi manuscripts of Yerushalmi and one through the manuscripts of Bavli. Perhaps it's even more than that, but in any case, we're talking about an ancient work dating back to the times that we would consider, in general, the times of Chazal. That being said, if we look in the Ravya in Maseches Brachas, the Ravya quotes Yerushalmi as follows. In order to understand this Yerushalmi, you have to understand the backdrop of the Yerushalmi. There's a Mishnah regarding the Zman Kriyas Shema Shel Shacharis. When is it? When do you start Kriyas Shema Shel Shacharis? Mishiyakar Bein Tchelos Lelovim. Lezer Eimer Bein Tchelos Lekarti. Right? Tchelos Lelovim, obviously you can tell them apart. One's dark, one's light. That, by the way, had a lot of influence. Perhaps this should be referenced for a different sugya. In the Quran, in Surah Al-Baqar, it talks about the time when you have to stop eating in Ramadan. And it says, when you can tell apart the black string from the white string. You familiar with this? Okay. In any case, there's no doubt that he's borrowing from Mishayakar, like many other things in Islam. By the way, contemporary Muslim scholars have missed the reference entirely. And say perhaps it's a black thread of dawn. No idea what that means. They're not either sure. I searched online a couple of times, you know, for contemporary Muslims in England. Yeah, at which time somebody actually asked, should I like buy myself a black thread and white thread and try to tell them apart? See, there's a lot of discussions online about that. A couple of great Muslim forums. There's no doubt that what he's getting from, he's coming from the Mishayakar and Tchelos Lekarti. Tchelos Lelovim, I'm sorry. And that gives you a fair indication when there's sufficient light to use it for something. Bein Tchelos Lekarti is a little more puzzling. Karti could mean the vegetable. You buy for a Shoshana, probably no other time from the year, during the year, most of us at least. At least most of us Ashkenazim, I have no idea what Sephardim do or don't put in their foods. And it's a vegetable. Karti, in English we'd call it leek. There's a different girsa in the Rishonim, in pretty much all over the world, in manuscripts, in the Karag Niza. Instead of Bintchilos Lekarti, it says Bintchilos Lekarton. And nobody really knows what Karton means. And if you look in the Rishonim, they raise the possibility perhaps Karton is some other form of the word Karti, meaning a fabric the color of Karti. So this Shiloh was discussed in Tkufas Rishonim. Not really so relevant, l'alach l'maisa, but we really, want to know what the Mishnah is saying. And the Rav Yehuda brings both potential to study. And he says, listen, we have a Yerushalmi that says, bin tchilos lekarti, bin profirin, or bin prasinan, prasinon. If you were to open up a printed Rav Yehuda, you find a slightly different gersa that has served to confuse the subject tremendously. Many people agreed over the years that if we'd have a clear translation from Chazal of Tchelos as Porphyra, that would be enough theoretically to link Tchelos with that ancient Porphyra dye in the literature, which we still haven't yet discussed how I would know today what that is. But people said, no, you have no real proof. The girsa that they had in front of them was being Porphyrin or being Prefinin. And there's a lot of wonderful, great speculations of what on earth Porphyrin and Prefinin is. A lot of yeshivish people are having a great fun time working out folk etymologies. Prefinin can mean whatever you want it to mean. Actually, it doesn't mean anything in particular. You won't find any real meaning. And I have a couple of fun correspondences with various scholars of ancient Greek. No, there's no such thing as Prefinin. But of course, people said, no, Prefinin is the real Porphyra, and no, Tchelos is something else. Or perhaps, and the general way of dismissing the Yerushalmi is a lot easier. You have no real way of seeing from this Yerushalmi what on earth Tchelos is. Why? If you look at the Gemara, Bein Tchelos Lekarti is only one of the ways to tell things apart, but there's also Bein Chamor La'arid, you have to tell a donkey from some other animal. Go know what it is. Mishiyak is Chaveri, you know. And Dalaram is Chaver, that's not too familiar, not familiar. I don't know. Those aren't Tchelos. So maybe the Yerushalmi is just saying that there's another time. Bein Tchelos Lekarti, and there's also Bein Porphyrin and Porphyrin. How would you know otherwise? Especially since we have no idea what Porphyrin is. Baruch Hashem, the Rebbein Hashem sent to us one manuscript that was preserved, actually wasn't preserved, thanks to none other than Ben-Gurion. It was entirely microfilmed. It belonged to, I think, the Basin of London's manuscript library. It was sold. The track of the manuscript has been lost. But over there, it didn't say Prefinin. It said Prasinan. A couple of years ago, another manuscript went up on auction, a different sefer, Sefer HaSufis, from a grandson of the Ravya, with extensive quotations in the Ravya. And a friend of mine was preparing an article for it, about it, for, I think, for the auction house, a tremendous scholar by the name of Rav Mordechai Honig. And he found a snippet that you'll see in middle of the centerfold. You can see a manuscript, obviously an Ashkenazi manuscript. Worth reading it, so you can see yourselves. Me'emes ha'kerin ha'shma b'shachard. Mishiyakar b'ntchilis ha'lovener. V'liezer ha'imer b'ntchilis ha'karton. Right? V'kibalti. I've been mekabel. She'min seva yesh ha'nikur karton. There's a certain type of dye that's called karton. V'daim l'tchilis, it is similar to tchilis. V'chein ikar. As opposed to the other potential explanation of karton, that it means a vegetable. How does he know this? The garcinum birushalmi. Bein tchilis l'karton, bein porfiron, ubein prisinon. Now it so happens to be that the translation of leek, karti, in Greek, would be prasinon. I don't know how many people know about the famous riots, I think at the riots in Constantinople. There was tremendous riots over the charioteer's riots. I'm the yeshiva guy. Say there. There was in Byzantium, there were a number of different chariot teams, and bizarrely enough, there were even political factions connected intimately with the different chariot teams. The empress was pro one team, and the emperor a different team. There was many intrigues to do with this. But one of the things that you do see is that we have the names of their uniforms. And one of the teams, the green team, is called the Prasinon team, right? Because they're wearing leek green clothes. So you know that karti is a translation. If you follow therefore the statement, Bintchil is the karton, and Prasinon is karton, so now we can work backwards. Porfiron is obviously the translation of tchilas. The reason why this doesn't turn up anywhere in Chazal, and this is a question that's been brought up, I think, legitimately. People ask, why don't Chazal anywhere tell you what tchilas is? You know, if tchilas is porfir, why don't they just go ahead and tell you that? I think that's an unfair question, because at the time of Chazal, it was very, very matter of fact. This is something everybody has. They don't have to explain to you what a chaloin is and many other things. And therefore, they don't feel the need to explain to you what tchilas is. Tchilas is tchilas. Why would you bother translating? We've all got it on our tzitzis, assuming, of course, we're wearing tzitzis, right? We're not going to translate that to a local Greek word. The only reason they needed to was to clarify the context of karton in the Mishnah. Now, why was it so important for the Yerushalmi to clarify it? If you look at the regular Yerushalmi, you could suddenly understand where it fits into the Yerushalmi. The Yerushalmi tries to give background for this machlekes between Rabbi Elazar and the Chacham. And the Chacham say, bin tchilas lulavan. Why? Somehow, Uri'isem Oisa in Tzitzis is connected to Zman Kriyishma. Don't ask me exactly how. It's in Parshas Tzitzis, right? Uri'isem Oisa, that's when Zman Kriyishma starts. And when you can see Oisa, meaning the tchilas. Okay. Now, seeing the tchilas, you can see tchilas in the middle of the night. You don't need any light. Obviously, what it means is that you could identify the tchilas and counter distinction to something else next to it. So what's the next thing over? Obviously, the white strings. Mishiyakim and tchilas, the lovin. When you can tell apart, when you can discern the tchilas from the lovin, that's Zman Kriyishma. Rabbi Eliezer says that that's not enough. You need to be able to tell tchilas that it's actually tchilas. In other words, to discern it from some other dyed material. In other words, we have tchilas, and we're going to look for the next dye over, the next color to the left or to the right, so to speak. And when I could tell those two apart, oh, then I've seen the tchilas midin tchilas. Tchilas is a dye. I've suddenly identified the tchilas. And what's the next dye over? Karton. So mishiyakim and tchilas karton, it's, the Yerushalmi explains, mishiyakir bein hatzivainin, or bein hatzivuin, amongst the dyed materials, I should be able to discern particularly tchilas, right? That wouldn't make any sense if I understood karton to be the vegetable karton, because it has nothing to do with different dyed things. That entire Yerushalmi wouldn't make any sense without giving you the elucidation that when we refer to karton, we mean the dye fabric, dyed the color, of the leek. In order to give you this background and to clarify it, the Yerushalmi goes ahead and translates it. Why this would have been dropped out of Yerushalmi is fairly obvious. The copyists in the West may not have understood this, and this would entirely have been irrelevant to them, and like many other such statements, it disappeared. One of the Gemaras I found for this, another favorite sugya of mine, Rashi originally gave a translation, or so it would seem from the earliest manuscripts we have of Rashi. Rashi gives a translation in Old French of all the stones of the Cheshen. As Rashi was copied over through the generations, this translation falls out because it was meaningless to people further out to the east. And so it happens. It's not a very surprising thing. This statement, Bein Tchelos Akarti, Bein Porphyrin, Bein Prasinon, theoretically would conclusively link Tchelos with Porphyra. If that weren't enough for me, I have a number of other people through the generations who did the same research and came to the same conclusion, amongst them Chavis Yar, who mentions B'derach Agav Mamish in the corner of some manuscript, Karachayim on Arachayim. He says, you know, by the way, Tchelos, we're talking about Mishiyakar, is not blue, it's purple, and it's made from the Porphyra fish. How he knew that, we have no idea. We have an index to all the works of the Chavis Yar called Ya'ir Nasiv. You can see from that index that the Chavis Yar had the most fantastic wide rate of range of interests. You can also see how much he wrote on each and every subject. I think there were 50 volumes of his encyclopedia. One or two volumes came to light over the years. The majority of them didn't. And in there, in his index, we actually made a group project, myself and a couple of friends. It's a few hundred pages. We split it up to all our different friends, and we read through page by page to see if we can find the statement where he mentions it. And he writes here that he had a full siman about this. You just have no idea what he said in that siman. There's a book, however, that he writes in that index again that he copied extensively out of that book. The book is called Shilte Agibern. It's a book about the Beis HaMikdash and a lot of other interesting subjects. And in there he writes again, B'derach Agav. Perfura is the, you can see it on the inside of the leaflet. I think that would be page 2. I just put a copy of that. Remes Hayam Shenik Aniku Perfura. V'achalazen Shetzevim Beit Chelis. The Shilte Agibern doesn't either tell us how he knows this, but both the Shilte Agibern and the Chavis Yar were very, very widely read in the classics. And therefore, they could have read it in Pliny the Elder, just like I did. Pliny, Aristotle, and many others. This wasn't a secret information. The question, of course, is brought up then, why didn't anybody go ahead and try to dig up the Tchelos? Why didn't the Chavis Yar go to the Yam? I think that's equally fair to the question why the Chavis Yar didn't move to Eretz Yisrael. You know, people had busy lives, they had a lot in their lives. I don't think people were as free to make choices as we are today. And even if you would have been free to make the choices, I don't know if the Chavis Yar would have known that if he would go to the Yam, he would necessarily find Tchelos. How do you know what the Porphyra is? There's no end of snails. How would you know which snail the Porphyra is? There are a number of ways that we would be able to tell what the Porphyra is, which is how we actually know. There are many books through the ages, in the last 500 years since the Renaissance, that have discussed at great length various classical works, Pliny the Elder's works, and they discuss which snail of today's snails, after Linnaeus, what is the Porphyra of the ancients, and they all zeroed in on a snail called the Murex. It's this guy, by the way. The Murex trunculus, the Murex branderus. Over the years, it's gone through a whole bunch of other names, Trunculariapsis trunculus, Thais haemastoma, I don't know, a bunch of different names that are given over the years. I'm not sure where they're holding today. But it was pretty conclusively accepted as this snail. If that weren't enough for me, you can go to Greece, where they still eat these snails, and they still refer to them as Porphyra. Once again, you know, of course, you always like a good Messiah Lefitumai, to get it like nice and yeshivish. I had a Mephis Maisa. We all like Mephis Maisas. I had a summer camp years ago. For whatever reasons, you know, you're flying. I flew from the United States to Eretz Yisrael with my Bachram, a number of the Bachram together. I said, you know, you should recover yourself. An airplane is a place where you're put in a lot of positions situations different than the Beis Medrash. Yeah. There's a makam to be nizhar and extra shmiras. And people sitting there don't know what they're watching. If you mekabel, I said, mekabel on yourself, have proper shmiras. And I'm to behave like a bentera. The Rebbeinu Shem always gives you siyata shma. You'll sit next to someone interesting. I said, watch. I guarantee you, next to me, there's either going to be someone interesting or an empty seat. This is my mefus for them. A little bit of a statistical catch. If you're a curious enough person, there's no such thing as a person out there that's not interesting. Okay? Over the years, though, I've sat next to, Rav Yitzchak Zilber, the famous Rav Yuznik. I sat next to some tremendous Yemenite scholar. I've had a lot of interesting people I sat next to. Again, the boring people are also interesting. In any case, we got onto the flight, and sitting next to me is this elderly guy from Manhattan, and the Bachman nudging me like, okay, no, where's the Rabbi's Mephis? I wish music, I could not get anything interesting out of him. Some boring old gentleman from, I don't know, we are in New York. And at some point, they asked, like, why are you flying to Israel? I said, no, I'm not flying to Israel. There's a stopover. Yeah, you have a point there. So where is your final destination? He says, I'm just going to visit my family and my childhood friends in Greece, where I come from. I said, cool, one second. Fuck, I'm coming here. Listen to this. I said, we're exactly in Greece. He said, no, you'd never have heard of it. Actually, this is where I called him over. You'd never have heard of it. I grew up in this little fishing village in Greece. I said, a fishing village? Really, now? That's how I called the Bachram. I said, tell me, did you ever hear the Porfura? He said, Porfura? Of course, Porfura. You have to make sure that you're wearing slippers, he says, when you're going on the beach. Because if you step on a Porfura, your feet are going to kill for the next week. Some of them have nastier spikes than this one. It's a pretty apt description. But I said, one second. You'd recognize a Porfura if you'd see one? He said, of course. I open up my computer, and I have some graphics from I don't know where and when. We have a bunch of different pictures of different snails. I said, can you pick out the Porfura? And, I'm a bunch of Bachman waiting with bated breath for the Rebbe to be proven wrong, right? And he looks in and says, oh, there it is. Yeah, I remember those spikes. I remember. I'm not forgetting them. And he picked it out without any difficulty. You don't really need to use this joke. I'm saying you can go there to Greece. The reason why I bring the story is that you obviously could counter if you can make such a dive from it. Maybe somebody used this scholarly work, this identification of these different scholars, and revived the name. But it's not an actual Masiach L'Pitumai. I don't think that would be likely, given the circumstances. I don't think that in random fishing villages in Greece, they were reading the scientific literature on the identification of the Porfura, the ancients, with today's Truncularyamsis trunculus. Somehow, I think they weren't doing that. Usually, we wouldn't need to go further than this. I think this identification I've presented would really be enough for Chazal, for Yishenim, to be Matar Aguna. I think the identification should be fairly conclusive. If that weren't really enough for us, there are a number of little bits and pieces of information that we have about the Chalazim that I think we'd be able to use as Simonim V'Hakim. Again, the difference between a Simon Muvak and a Simon She'enim Muvak, if we look through Rishayim, perhaps regarding an Aveda, if I had to lose my watch, right? There are a number of different kinds of simonim I could give. Some of them wouldn't be simonim at all. Some of them would be simonim she'enim of hakim, which if you have enough of them, perhaps it would be a simon. Some of them would be a simon mavak. So for example, if I were to say, oh, you found my watch, yeah, it tells the time, right? It's not a simon at all, right? That would be pretty much parallel to saying, and I'm not going to go into this by Arichas, but I would find the Medrash that the Chalazin has a shell. Oh, that's simon number one as to what the Chalazin is. No, it's not a simon at all. You just repeated your original statement that the Chalazin is a snail. If I were to say that, you found my watch. Yeah, it has a leather band. Yeah, it's the one with the leather band. Still didn't really give a simon muvak. Why? Although not all watches have a leather band, that's entirely not unique to my band, to my watch. But if I were to say that in the back there's a funny scratch that looks a little bit like a Y, and in the inside of the Y you see there's a slight discoloration, I think that would be a simon muvak. So whenever we're talking about simanim for the tchelis, we would have to consider, are we looking for a simon? Would this be considered a simon muvik or a simon she'enoi muvik? One of the things that I would say is a simon muvik is the fact that it can make a steadfast die. Steadfast dies, if you think about it, are rarity. Really, 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 things, whenever I put together any two materials, I should expect them to fall apart, to decay. If I put paint on the house, the paint falls down, right? Because there's no integral binding of the paint to the stone. If I stain something, you give it a couple of washes and it fades away. Which is why in ancient times, dyes were so valuable, such a precious commodity, and why they were often miyuchad for royalty. This is something that regular people weren't able to afford. In order to dye something, there was a tremendous amount of science that had to be known. At the time, it would be science that was brought about through trial and error. And that wasn't something that was easy to make. In ancient times, they might not have known how to, you know, they knew how to make wine. It took quite a while until people realized that you could theoretically take the yeast from the grapes and make wine out of apple juice, right? You find the Gemara Yein Tapuchim, they had the idea of it, but it took a long time and a lot of trial and error to figure out what's going on. In order to make a proper dye, if it was able to get into the wool, absorbed into the wool, theoretically, kibbutz kachpelte, the same way like blias in a pot, to be able to get come out the same way it went in. In order to change that, you need a very, very complicated process. Not all dyes in the ancient world had that. If I have another dye that was considered an extremely steadfast dye that was also blue and the color of Kali Ilan and also made from a snail, I think that would be enough to clinch it. There are a lot of other little yediyas. Another one, the Gemara Masechet Shabbos mentions Bederech Agav, that when you crunch the shell, so I'll have to finish in a moment. When you crush the shell to get the dye out, you would be careful that it shouldn't die. At the very least, it would be loy nichle. You'd prefer it not to die. It so happens to be that Pliny the Elder mentions again, Bederech Agav, that when you're making the dye from the perfura, you wouldn't want it to die because after it dies, it spits out the juice, it absorbs the juice. Unclear what exactly it means, but that would still be the case today. Over here I have a sheep. I took a snail, let's see if I can still find the part. Immediately after I killed it, I crushed the shell, and I took the dye gland, and I folded it up into the begad, and it gave me a beautiful dark dye that went straight through. I did this again, it went through, I think, 6 or 7 folds of fabric. I did this again later with the snail that I waited for it to die, took out the gland. There was so little dye stuff that it barely even left a stain, despite the fact that I tried rubbing it. There are multiple reasons for this, but it's certainly enough to demonstrate what Pliny the Elder was talking about and what the Gemara is talking about. Again, we're talking about multiple different things that I would say would be simanim vakim. Really? Really? What you would expect is the fact, like we started off the share. Okay, sounds pretty reasonable. Let's just go for a Safik Dereis L'Chumra at the very least. If not a Safik Dereis L'Chumra because of some kind of Lamda Shechapa. It's not a Safik Dereis L'Chumra. The way the Mesillas Yesharim puts it, I think in the beginning of Shara Zahiris, that a person who's Eved Hashem, when he looks at a mitzvah, he says, could this potentially bring me closer to the Rebbeinu Shalom? If yes, I'm going to run after it. That's the way he looks with mitzvahs. Theoretically, I think that what we've seen already today, even without going into all the finer, the small letters and the Rashi script and the various other Marmukaimas that we could check up, I think really this should be enough to demonstrate it. Lamaisa, what it boils down to, and again, I don't think it's a fact, even in people's minds, that you're waiting for the Gula to bring about the Tchelis. Klal Yisrael tends, and it's a good thing so, Klal Yisrael tends to be very, very conservative. Just like any body of law is by nature conservative, and you have strange people in the United States still analyzing the Constitution, despite the fact that it was written by a bunch of kids my age, right, younger than me, and not necessarily people with Ruach HaKodesh, but we all understand and respect the fact even, again, even people who are not coming mitzad aruchnias to kecheshbon, even without any ruchnias to kecheshbon, we're all well aware of the fact that keeping things stable and constant is an extremely important value that doesn't go any different, and perhaps even more so when it comes to halacha. And Mimela in general, I entirely understand this, the attitude of the vast majority of people in this room is probably going to be that if we didn't see our Rebbeim wearing it, so seder, we're not going to go on to it. But at the very least, I think what the Shir should have effectuated is when you see the people wearing chelas, your automatic reaction shouldn't be, hey, why is that guy wearing chelas? I think we should have flipped that reaction by now to, hey, why am I not wearing chelas?